Hello, and welcome to episode 228 of The Ethical Life, a weekly podcast that explores the intersection of ethics and modern life. I'm Scott Rada, a digital strategist with Lee Enterprises, and I am joined, as always, by Rick Kite, who is head of the Ethics Institute at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Scott.
This is the time of year when a lot of people are making, or at least contemplating, big life-changing decisions. New jobs, new relationships, new habits, and even new selves. And when people feel stuck or uncertain, they often seek advice from friends, from experts, from books, and sometimes even from podcasts like this one. But there's something we don't talk nearly enough about when we give or receive advice, and that's luck. I'm convinced that chance plays a much bigger role in our lives than most of us are comfortable admitting, and that ignoring that fact can distort how we judge ourselves and others. Rick, today I want to talk about luck, advice, and decision-making, and what recognizing the role of chance might change about how we live. Why do you think we're so reluctant to admit how much luck shapes our lives, especially in a culture obsessed with self-improvement?
Well, framing our lives as subject to luck doesn't leave us much room for agency. So there's not a lot we can do about that. And yet there is a lot we can do to kind of shape the direction of our lives. And I think what we want is to optimize the amount of influence that we can have over events, especially over uncertain events. That the problem is, like, understanding just what, realistically, what the extent of our abilities are.
I mean, I guess first, do you agree that most of us underappreciate the role luck plays in our lives?
I'm not so sure about that.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
I'm pretty confident that's the case. I mean, I'll give you my best reason why. I mean, and frankly, a lot of it starts with, like, where we're born. I mean, I saw the other day, and obviously neither of us were literally born yesterday, but if you were born yesterday, there is, like, a huge percent chance that you're from a part of the world that is not nearly as wealthy as ours, that the health outcomes aren't as good as ours, and the education opportunities are not nearly as good as what we have both have living here in the United States. I mean, right there, that seems like a huge piece of luck. And beyond that, I think there are things that happen to us all the time that I don't want to for a second say we have no agency over our lives, but just certain the people we meet sometimes, the places we find ourselves in, the jobs we get, a lot of that is really beyond our control and really is determined by things that are, I guess, probably just luck.
Yeah, and I would distinguish a bit between, you know, what the ancients used to call fortuna, the things like where you're born, the family you're born, your genetics, all these things. Mm-hmm. That's good or bad fortune.
Right? Okay.
And luck, I think we often apply to the outcomes of chance events, and so like flipping a coin comes up heads or tails, those sorts of things. And so there's a lot of luck in some of the things you mentioned, like what job you get is often determined by economic conditions. It's determined by, like, who else applies, for example.
Yeah.
Like all kinds of things determine, like, what you end up doing in life. I would agree with you in this respect, that we underappreciate the extent to which we ought to be grateful for many of the good things that happen in our lives. I think there's generally an overemphasis on how much a lot of those good things are actually due to our actions and due to our intentions when they aren't. So I would agree with you about that. The reason I don't think that people underestimate luck too much is I still see a lot of people, like when I go to a convenience store, buying lottery tickets, pull tabs at a bar, that sort of thing. Like, these have become really commonplace in our society. And this is all placing a lot of trust in luck.
And I think we would agree that although we may not quite agree on how much luck influences our lives, luck is not a strategy, right?
I would say we call things luck when we're talking about whether chance outcomes correspond to our desires or not. So when I have a chance outcome that corresponds to my desire, for example, we're flipping a coin and we've got money riding on it, on heads or tails. And I call heads, it comes up heads, I'll call it good luck. Comes up tails, I'll call it bad luck. But it's just it's a chance event, it's random. But we're much better off calling those things chance and then talking about them in terms of probability.
Mm-hmm.
And once we talk about them in terms of probability, there's all kinds of things that we can do to increase or decrease probabilities.
Even though we may look at the contributing factors of this a little differently, I think we both agree that whether we control 50, 60, 70% of our life's outcomes, the things we do are like ridiculously important in helping determine how our lives are. I mean, yeah, we all know people who have done all the right things and who have made all what seem to be the right choices, and things just haven't worked out for them. And again, that's too bad. That's not how it usually goes. And again, I think we're in agreement that acknowledging the role chance plays in our lives is important, but we can't simply use that as saying, well, all of life is a coin flip, so why should I even try?
Yeah, and that's a defeatist attitude, I think. So much of what we do, we're better off if we're looking at it realistically and we have some understanding of what are the underlying conditions that contribute to the probability of different chance events happening. And so we take a context, for example, we can look at happiness studies and we find that it's overwhelmingly the case that you have a set point at which your kind of happiness resides that's largely determined by genetics. And then that can be raised or lowered both by things that happen to you. And these are mostly chance events. You're in a car accident and you're seriously injured or you win the lottery, things like that. And then there's what you can do and the things that you can do, a number of things like socialize and exercise, a number of things that you could do to raise that. And so both go into determining how happy you are. We're much better off if you understand that, then you can take some action and be realistic about it. And I mentioned that because this applies to just about anything we do in life. So, for example, you want to increase the odds that you can get a good job. Well, you're much better off making sure that you're realistically about what you're applying for, that you prepare for it, that you have good qualifications, that you take advantage of networking. Like, there's all these things that you can do because there is some luck that comes into it, but there's a lot you can do to increase the odds in your favor.
And part of the reason we're talking about this topic is, like I said at the start, is January is a time where a lot of people are sort of taking a look at their lives, taking a look at how they want, in this case, 2026 to be better, at least on a personal level from the year before, and things they can do. And we all know those resolutions people make around health and eating better and repairing maybe frayed relationships. But, you know, we've all had advice from various people, and I do not remember who told me this. But it's one, you know, somebody tells you something, and for whatever reason, it'll stick with you, right? And this has always stuck with me, and I think it's true, but I'd be curious your take on this. I don't even remember, somebody told me this a long, long time ago. And I don't even remember what was going on in my life, but apparently what was going on in my life was there was maybe a lot, because I think I maybe had moved recently or had a job change and maybe a relationship change. And there was just a lot happening. And the person tried to convince me, and I think it's true, is that when you have a lot of change going on in your life, that in some ways is the best time to redirect your priorities, redirect what you're, you know, really trying to do, because all those things that have felt comfortable and predictable maybe aren't there or not there in the same way. And I often think about that at this time of the year, and I guess probably maybe because I'm lucky, who knows? But like, I'm not facing any of these like big challenges as the new year starts. But part of me wonders if I was, is that sort of the time? And do you agree with that advice that when you're facing all these, you know, two or three changes in your life, that's the time where you really can sort of choose to make things better?
Well, absolutely, because during that time of change, that transitional time, what you are doing is you're working to establish new habits in some areas of your life. And it's these habits that keep us from being able to change in the first place. So when you have the external circumstances that create some disruption, so you've already made some changes, that's the best time to say, okay, like, what are some other changes I want to make? Because you're already in the mode of establishing some new habits. And like, what you want to do is establish habits that are good for you, right? That's always the kind of change we're trying to make.
And that's the danger, right? Is that you're in this moment and all these things are happening, and maybe some are good, maybe some aren't good. And it can sometimes, I think, feel overwhelming to people that all this is happening at once. And then you take what were sort of like maybe okay habits, and then like all these changes happen and all of a sudden you're making worse habits. So I mean, that is sort of the danger when you get to these pivot points, is that I guess I just raise that because for people listening who maybe are going through that or about to go through that, it is something I think that we maybe don't talk enough about, is if it's something, you know, I think moving is like a really good example, right? I mean, and whether that means from one place to another in the city in which you live or whether it's a cross-country move, that just really, there's few things that can change your routines more than that. And if you've always wanted to do something, well, finding a way to work it into that new routine instead of like trying to break an old one, that just seems like the time to do it. And frankly, not be, and really be kind of hold yourself accountable for that.
Yes. And, you know, I think you're onto something about these times where like changes are already happening in our life. Those are the times where we are really open and receptive to advice, because we're looking for something different. And we often get advice at times where things are settled and we're not really looking to make the change and so forth. And even and people want us to make the change, but it's unwelcome advice because we aren't looking to make those changes at that point. And I always think the best advice is the advice that we're seeking. Like that's what sticks with you. At times in your life where you've got things going or you're comfortable where you are and you're not looking to change and somebody's telling you to do something different, that's often the most unwelcome kind of advice.
When we sort of talked about this on a recent show, I think, I guess what we talked about specifically was times where it's okay to ask for help. And I guess this is sort of tangential to that, but sometimes it's okay to ask for advice. And I think some of the same rules apply. We said in that show that people like feeling useful, like being asked to help at times. But also, I mean, depending on the project, if you have a trench to dig and I said, hey, Rick, what are you doing Saturday? Want to help come build me dig a trench? I mean, maybe you would, maybe you wouldn't. But like, that's like real work. But if I like ask for advice, I mean, in some ways that says to someone, not only do I want your opinion, but like you're someone who seems to have your stuff figured out, and that you're and that you, and it gives somebody maybe more of a mental exercise instead of digging a trench, as my example was. But I guess, what do you think about when you're asking others for advice? Are there people you turn to who you think have sort of things figured out? Or do you maybe think about people who have overcome a lot of adversity, who maybe, you know, have had those, like we talked about, those pivot points happen pretty often in their lives?
Yeah, both. And I think there's a great deal to learn from people who've faced adversity and overcome it, if you are facing that same kind of adversity and kind of understanding how did they see things at the time, what did they do in response, there are just some general people that I rely on quite a bit who I just regard as quite wise and that have been good mentors, and I'll seek their advice on certain kinds of things, but not on others. I don't think there's anybody that I go to for every kind of advice. But I'll give you an example of a change I've made in the last 6 months or so, where I was seeking advice, and that is it. About a year ago, I went in for my annual exam, as we often do, and found out that my cholesterol numbers, which had been tracked every couple of years and had been kind of a little bit high, had risen significantly. And also looking back my family history, there's a history of heart disease and stroke. And so like when you've got the two of those things, some family history and then high numbers of cholesterol, my doctor wanted me to go on statins. I wasn't real enthusiastic, but I thought, well, that seems like the only choice. But there's some downsides, not a lot of them, but some downsides of the statins, increased muscle pain and things like that. And so I started seeking advice, like what else can I do? What can I do to lower my odds of some kind of adverse cardiovascular event? I'm really grateful right now for, like, this is what the internet provides. There's a lot of quacks out there, but you can find some like pretty consistent advice backed up by reputable studies, some meta-analysis, things like that. You can find a lot of good things. And so I've made some pretty significant changes that were hard for about a month to change diet and exercise routines because we you know, you get into certain habits, it's really hard to change them. And yet, I'm finding like my numbers have never been better now.
Without the pharmaceutical.
I'm taking the lowest dose of statins. Okay. But I went from a higher dose down to a lower because my numbers are so good. And it's diet and losing weight and a few other things. And I'm really grateful for that kind of advice. But I don't think, like before that, I don't think I would have been interested in it or I wouldn't have had the motivation to follow that kind of advice. There's so much advice about everything out there, right? When you're looking for something, it's a lot easier to than pay attention and follow ultimately good advice.
Well, and you mentioned advice, and you actually shared this with me in preparation for today's show. But just before the first of the year, Melissa Kirsch at the New York Times shared trolled for submissions from readers asking them about the best advice they had ever received. And she published, and we'll certainly link to this, and I don't would it count them, but I would say maybe three dozen things that people wrote in from all over the country. And I mean, like, I think some of them are fine. One that sort of stuck out to me, Kaylee Davis in Fuquay, Varina, North Carolina. And I have been to Fuquay, Varina, North Carolina, by the way. My father used to live there. She wrote, "Anxiety is not intuition." And I thought that was like kind of a clever, you know, thing. But like so many, I mean, and a lot of these, you know, don't make what someone told you into your narrative, says Gene Anderson in Florida. I mean, there are all these things. I guess I think there's also a time where sort of these simple, and every one of these examples is like one, two, or perhaps three sentence pieces of advice. I worry sometimes that those quick little quips sort of minimize what people are going through. And the one I hate, and it was absolutely not in this New York Times list, it's overused. I think it's a lazy piece of advice people give. But if somebody comes to you, someone, and maybe we've even talked about on the show, I don't quite remember because I rant about this a lot. But when somebody comes and like has like a legitimate worry or like, I just don't know how I'm going to get through the next week. I have this going on and that going on and these seven things and all these barriers are in my way. And then the person's response is, "You got this," I think is like the worst thing to say. And that's like, and again, I think all the the examples in the Times piece were better than that. But I do think there are times where, like, if somebody came with some worry and I said, what was that line? Anxiety is not your...
Is not a strategy?
Is not intuition.
It's not intuition.
I mean, like, I think that's, like, a good thing to think about. But, like, I don't think that would be a good response to someone who's facing a really difficult situation. So I guess, do you think those... I mean, I know you read through the list, too. I mean, one, did anything stand out to you? Or two, do you think those little axioms can be useful at times? I guess my position is they can be useful to, like, reading them and thinking about them internally is fine, but, like, saying them to others is probably not. But I don't know. What do you think?
Well, what you're talking about, like, oftentimes when we're compelled to give advice, it's at the moment of decision or the moment of crisis for a person. Mm-hmm. And that's when they're often least receptive to it. I think they're very, many of them were very good to think about. The problem is, I read through and I thought, like, a lot of these are really good. By the next day, I'd forgotten all of them.
Mm-hmm. Apparently, I'd forgotten one in about, like, 20 seconds after reading it.
Right. But what it made me do is go back and think through, like, are there bits of advice that I picked up years ago that have become really important to me? They were usually things that I picked up from somebody's incidental remark. And I think it was because I was looking for something of the kind, looking for a way to think about that problem. One of them was, I remember reading somebody say, think about what you do, one thing you do well, and do it better than anybody else. I remember coming across that at a time where I was feeling really distracted and I was being pulled in many directions at once at work. And I was trying to be competent at least at all of them and felt like I was doing none of them adequately, and realized I think I'd be much better off if I would just pick one or two things and really focus on them. And so that's like it came at a moment where it was really helping me kind of figure out how am I going to focus on what should be done here.
But if I heard you right, though, you said you heard someone say this. It wasn't like you walked over to someone and say, hey, I have a problem. I need your help solving it. And I'm not surprised to hear that. I think many of the things that sort of stick with us are kind of delivered serendipitously at just the right time.
I think that's exactly right.
Because that's why luck is important.
Well, no, it's not just luck. It's because you're already receptive.
Yeah.
Because we're hearing all kinds of things. To be receptive and then to come across the right kind of advice that's the best thing for you to hear and pay attention to at the moment, you have to be engaged with people. You have to be talking to people. You have to be reading things. So that it's not just luck. What you do is you increase the odds of coming across really applicable advice if you're both receptive and you're engaged with the sorts of people that are able to give it.
And I'm sort of leading the witness by asking this question because I'm pretty sure I know your answer. But we just talked a minute ago about reading through a list the New York Times had about advice people sent in from across the nation. And like, that's fine. And there's, you know, YouTube and other short form video. There is virtually no limit to how much advice giving there is out there in our digital landscape. But it sounds like what you're saying is those things can be useful. And I guess it was, right, in your, you know, kind of motivating you to make some diet changes to lower your cholesterol. And I think a lot of that came from, like, looking at actual real health research. But, like, those other kind of interpersonal things, those are really best done when you're interacting with, like, real people in real time in person, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, why do you think that is?
There are ways of being pretty active in what you read and what you watch and listen to, but it can't be just like reading or watching or whatever is entertaining at the time. That's the difference. So you go out and you actively search. So this is, then you're engaged in a kind of conversation, say with the author or with the speaker. So when I'm looking for, say, for example, nutrition advice, I'm being really selective in who I'm paying attention to, and I'm asking questions of them. But then I'm also talking to friends and so forth. So some of it is real people that we're engaged with. But I also, like, we have relationships with authors, for example, and we ask some questions. I turn to Emerson all the time.
He's been there for a long time.
And I think he gives great advice. And so I'm often looking to him, but I'm reading him with something in mind. Like, what does he say, for example, about friendship? What does he say about beauty? And I think he's got great advice for the person who wants to go and look for it.
Before we close on this topic, I did want to go back to the topic we started with, and that was about luck. And there was an essay in Psych on the Psych website, and we'll link to it, that does, I think, make an important point. And it argues that recognizing the role of chance can also make us more humble, more compassionate, and less judgmental. And I think there is some truth to that, right? Because if we find someone who's in, you know, a really bad situation, could they have made a better choice before getting to that spot? Probably. But, like, some of it may just be what we talked about at the start of the show. It could have just been bad luck. And I think that realizing that about others does make us more empathetic. Do you agree?
Absolutely. I get to interact with a lot of people with very different kinds of histories and personalities and different problems they're facing. You know, like my students. And once I get to know my students well, I learn something about their life story, and it's really fascinating. But people are beset by all kinds of problems that go far beyond what we notice on casual acquaintance. And I think learning people's stories and understanding, like, how they've responded to them, it makes us both grateful, but also I admire people so much. What so many people I know have overcome, and like how they've managed to make something of a success of their lives. I'm not saying, like, talking about people who've reached great heights. I mean, just like building a normal life. There's all kinds of people that have overcome great difficulties to build something like a normal life. And I find that really admirable.
We end each show by tackling an ethical dilemma. And Rick, here is my question for you. And as I have done in past years, in early January, I have taken a question, or in this time, two questions, from the Conundrum episode of one of my favorite podcasts called the Slate Political Gabfest. So I will give you the first one, which we can both discuss, and then the second question I have no opinion about, so I will leave that one all to you.
Sounds good.
The first one is, Rick, you get a chance to go back in time and attend one concert, theatrical performance, sporting event of your choice. What would you pick and why?
I would pick going back to a sporting event that my grandfather took me to when I was about 10 years old.
Okay.
At the Fargo Coliseum. They had pro wrestling was at the Fargo Coliseum one night.
I would have guessed you were going here.
My grandfather and his buddies, he had a gang of four buddies that went every month. And once in a while, they would have an extra ticket if one of them couldn't come. And so he picks me up and took me to this pro wrestling
event. How far is a drive to Fargo for you?
60 miles.
Okay, so an hour drive each way.
It was in February. It was really cold, and they had the windows rolled up. Two of them were smoking cigarettes. The guy next to me was smoking a pipe, and the other guy had a cigar. We got 5 miles down the road. It was so smoky in that car, you couldn't even see out the windows. I pulled my coat up over my mouth, and I breathed through it the whole time. That was a miserable. I wouldn't want to do that part again. But we get there, and because this group, my grandpa in his Stetson hat and his cowboy boots, he's the gang leader of this group. We all march in there. They've got ringside seats permanently reserved because they've been going there for years. Mm. So we get in there way ahead of everybody else, and we're going through the program. It's a long story. There's all kinds of adventures. I would love to go back and see if I remember this even remotely accurately, because I have such strong memories. But what topped it off is the last match of the night was two notorious bad guys, Larry Pretty Boy Henning and Dirty Dusty Rhodes, in a tag team match against two guys we'd never heard of. They were the saps that were going to get beat. And sure enough, they're in there beating up on each other. And at one point, Dirty Dusty Rhodes is in the ring. He's about to pin his opponent. And the referee is down on all fours, kind of seeing it, like they do a 10 count, right? Yep. And every time he'd get to about 8, the guy would lift his shoulder a little bit and the referee would have to start over. So the referee's got his back to us. Larry Pretty Boy Henning comes outside the ring and he sneaks up behind this other guy's partner on the outside of the ring and puts him in a chokehold, and it's right in front of us. My grandpa grabs a cane from the guy next to him, Dan Waters, was sitting there with his cane. My grandpa grabs a cane, runs up, and he whacks Larry Pretty Boy Henning over the head with a cane.
Oh, my gosh.
And the crowd goes wild. Larry Henning turns around. He grabs the cane out of my grandpa's hands. My grandpa just scoots back to his seat, and then he starts choking the guy with the cane, and everybody stands up in the auditorium and they're all shouting. The referee then turns around because something obviously has happened. And they go and he calls security guards. They wrestle the cane away from him. And then they're walking around looking, trying to find out, like, whose cane is this? And Dan Waters, he was the meekest, mildest little guy. And he just raises his hand like, it's mine. And they pick him up under each shoulder and they drag him out of the Coliseum. My grandpa never said a word. And It made such a powerful impression on me. I would love to go back and just be a witness. Like, did that really happen? And it did happen anything like I remember it? Because we know that memories are kind of notoriously unreliable. But I have such vivid memories of this happening. And I was, to be honest, I was so ashamed of my grandpa for not standing up for, you know, like taking credit for what he did.
So I have a whole lot of questions, but I'm going to stop at 3 questions. One, remind me how old you were at this time?
I was about 10, maybe 11.
Okay. And you or your, it was, I'm sorry, it was your father and your...
My grandpa and his buddies.
And his buddy, sorry, your grandpa.
Yep.
Between your small group, did you all believe this was real?
My grandpa and his buddies did, firmly. I mean...
And how about you at this moment in life?
Well, I was pretty impressionable.
Okay.
I had some questions.
Mm-hmm.
Like one of the first match was with Dan Scrap Iron Spajenski, and there was a picture of him. I remember this in the brochure, the program that we got, of him lying on the ground with a car parked on like on his gut. You know, like how tough he was, right? Yeah, and like about 3 matches later, I noticed the referee looked a lot like Dan Scrap Iron Spajenski. I asked my grandpa, is that him? No, it just looks like him. That's a different guy. And I was thinking, that can't be right. So I started having all these questions about, because it didn't seem quite real. But when you're with, adults who firmly believe this and everything, like I get caught up in that. So, like, it was a few years before I really started to question.
And sort of the biggest question I have here is, I mean, I presented this question very broadly. It could have been any concert, theatrical performance, sporting event, I guess.
Yeah, like the first Beatles concert or something. Like, it could have been anything.
I would have allowed, Rick, to go back to, like, ancient Greece and, like, hear Plato or some of these other dudes you talk about all the time.
Oh, yes, like the trial of Socrates.
Sure. Yeah. Like, almost limitless number of choices, and I find it fascinating that not only did you pick something in Fargo, North Dakota, but you're like the only person I know who would pick an event that they had already gone to. So I understand the
part. It had such an incredible influence. I mean, this was a formative experience. I think it's probably why I went into ethics.
Really? That's not true.
Well, in a way, I mean, I started questioning, like, from a fairly early age, like, do adults really know what they're doing?
Okay.
And like, how can you admire and love somebody and also think like what they did was really wrong, but not wrong in a way that hurt me?
Yeah.
That would have been, had a different effect, like just kind of objectively, like, that doesn't seem right, you know? And like, then I started questioning like all kinds of advice that adults were giving me. So I
and these people are dead, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so, but I mean, don't you think it might like hurt your memories of them to see how they were behaving in this crowded ringside seat in Fargo, North Dakota on a cold February night?
I want to see them with adult eyes.
Okay.
See, like what was really going on? Well, how did they really act? I really have no idea what I would see if mm-hmm. I went back and said, that's why I'm so curious. And this is like, yeah, I could pick another event that like I could go and observe and it would be really interesting. But I want to go and re-experience an event that was really formative for me.
That's a fascinating answer. Mine won't be nearly as fascinating, I guess. But I mean, there are certain music, theater, sporting events that are top of mind for me that I would like to experience. But the problem with like all of those is that you're in a, you know, if you know, Woodstock, I'm sure would make many people's list, right? Maybe probably wouldn't make mine. But like Woodstock, even though I don't know how many people were there, and I promise you there are more people who said they were there than are actually were there, but still there were a lot of people there over these couple of days. You weren't.
But if you had been there, you wouldn't remember it anyway.
Well, that may be true, but like you don't get to like, there's the number of people who actually got to interact with those musicians is really small. And I remember one of my favorite concerts I was at, and I don't need to go back, Rick, but I had it was a concert by a musician named Jill Sobule, and she sadly died about a year ago in a house fire. It was a very tragic thing. And I had seen her perform three times, and the most recent time was in Madison, Wisconsin at a very small venue. It was probably 40 people at the most. And I got a chance to chat with her a little bit at the end. And, you know, she was very, you know, very kind. I mean, she's exactly the person you wanted her to be over in person. And I enjoyed her music. I enjoyed hearing her perform. But I also enjoyed the time, you know, the 5 minutes we got a chance to chat. And I even got a chance to talk to her about the very first time I saw her perform in Dubuque, Iowa, many, many years ago. And she at least claimed she remembered that concert. And so I would like to think about a time, and maybe it would be someone who ended up being pretty famous, but I did not come up with the definitive answer for this segment of the show. I probably should have, but I would like to find a time where I could go and see someone, whether it's somebody in sports or somebody in music or somebody in theater, who I would see them so early in their career. It would be interesting to see them before they got famous. And hopefully, like I did with Jill, have a chance to actually have that 5-minute conversation, which you would never be able to do with someone if you're at game 7 of the World Series.
Right. So to see somebody like Bob Dylan performing in Greenwich Village, it's a small club, something like that.
Something like that. Bob Dylan may not be high on my list, but something like that, right? Or, you know, or even like, you could even broaden this like around politics. Like the first time, speech that young state Senator Barack Obama made in Springfield. I mean, something like that would be like interesting, especially someone who you see you saw in a public way so well many years later, to see what they were like when they were just getting started, I think would be fascinating. But I will tell you, answer's better than mine.
But I love your answer, and I think I would probably now, when I'm rethinking about it more broadly, if I could pick anything, I would want to go to one of Emerson's public lectures.
Oh, okay.
He gave about 800 of them or something all over the country, and he would pack the house. And
was anybody hitting someone with a cane during these, probably?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think they were pretty peaceful events, but without microphone. And apparently, you know, like everybody in the back of the room couldn't even hear what he was saying because he just stood at a lectern and he read a lecture. But I think that would be fascinating just to see how did that work and like what and how did he present? But there would be a lot of things like that that I'd be really curious about, and certain performers that I would love to see, like what you said at an early stage. I would love to see one of Emmylou Harris's first concerts.
So the other question that came up, and on the Gabfest conundrum show, which they do every year, they probably went through 20 of these. But the other one, as soon as they talked about it, and I should mention, too, the people on the show, the normal trio is John Dickerson, now formerly of CBS News, Emily Bazelon with the New York Times Magazine, and David Plotz, who runs a podcast company called The CityCast, were joined for this episode by Stephen Colbert, who, of course, is the host of The Late Show on CBS. And I believe, if my memory serves, both John Dickerson and Stephen Colbert are both big fans of Tolkien, or J.R.R. Tolkien? Am I saying that
right?
Right. So this question was kind of aimed specifically at them, and I know almost nothing about Tolkien. So this is all you, but the question is, if you could bring one character or object from the works of Tolkien to attempt to address our contemporary political troubles, who or what would it be and why?
I'm going to expand this a little bit from
character
or object, and I'm going to say the Shire.
Oh.
A place from the novels.
And I know enough. Okay, I said I knew nothing, but that's where the Hobbits sort of hung out.
Yeah, and it's where the story, the trilogy begins and ends, at the Shire. And the beginning and the ending, in a way, is about the destruction of the world and to a large extent, the destruction of the Shire as a place where friendships are formed and community is built, and the loss that's experienced when you have mighty people exercising a great deal of political power and military might in pursuit of their aims, kind of the damage that it causes to these kind of fragile environments that constitute the fabric of our communities. And so you're left at the end with this feeling of sadness about the damage inflicted on the Shire, but also some hope that there are people, these hobbits, determined to rebuild it. And I think when you talk about our contemporary political troubles, I think a lot of it has to do with the destruction of our social connections and destruction of community. And so if I could bring one thing from The Lord of the Rings, it would be an example of a really healthy community.
And again, I think what you're saying is sort of the Shire functioning at its best.
Yeah.
And is that something that
they had great pubs apparently?
And I'm knowing you not and knowing just the tiniest bit about Tolkien, that seems to make a ton of sense. And I suppose in some ways your most recent book was sort of about Third Places, was trying to recreate that shyness. That's not really a word in our world today, right?
Yeah, probably. I had never thought of it in that way, but that book, that set of books, was really influential on me. I read a lot of Tolkien's works and works by C.S. Lewis. This was when I was in high school. I wanted to understand like what informed their view of the world, and so I started looking at what had they read. That really shaped my path going into college and my ultimately studying philosophy was understanding the influence of history and philosophy on both of them.
So your ethical journey as a child was influenced both on reading Tolkien and on professional wrestling matches in Fargo.
Exactly.
Well, I guess for longtime listeners of the show, maybe that makes sense. As a reminder, the Ethical Life podcast is a production of Lee Enterprises. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And also be sure to check out Rick's column, which is always about ethics. And maybe, who knows, one day will be about professional wrestling. Nonetheless, that can all be found on all Lee websites. For Rick Kite, I am Scott Rada. Thank you for listening.